I'm Dave Heller, and this is NewsWorks Tonight. Ahead this evening, our commentator considers how much the Philadelphia School District will actually benefit from selling closed buildings. First, Governor Tom Corbett squares off tomorrow morning against Democrat Tom Wolf in the second debate of the Pennsylvania governor's race. WHYY's Dave Davies reports that in a campaign that's gone pretty badly for Corbett, there are a few encouraging signs for the governor.
Several independent polls have showed Corbett trailing Wolf by over 20 points, but a Mercyhurst University poll, the first since Corbett's strong showing at last week's debate, showed the margin at 15, at least moving in the right direction for the governor. Franklin and Marshall political scientist Stephen Medvick says he's not surprised to see the race tighten a bit.
But still, 5 weeks out, you know, to be down 15 or 20 points means that the governor has to make up 3 to 4 points a week to make this race close, and that's a tall order, I think.
The Corbett campaign has a new ad poking fun at Wolf. In it, actors comment on what they say are Wolf's tax plans.
It says here Tom Wolf's going to raise the income tax on middle-class families. It's about time somebody does.
We just have way too much money.
I'm working two jobs right now. There's no reason why I couldn't work a third.
The Wolf campaign says they're dead wrong, that his proposal to make the state income tax more progressive will cut taxes for lower and middle income families. But when Corbett challenged him for more details at last week's debate, Wolf said he didn't have the figures to calculate a specific rate. That earned him a scolding editorial from the Philadelphia Inquirer. Muhlenberg College political scientist Chris Borick says Corbett has an opening to exploit here.
To be honest, Tom Wolf has remained very vague, and his statements on taxes and a possible change of the tax code are somewhat vacuous.
Wolf campaign officials say their candidate doesn't know exactly what the fiscal condition of the state will be when he takes office, so it's difficult to be specific about numbers. Meanwhile, there's a titillating news story the Wolf campaign is doing its best to take advantage of, the revelation that some state officials, including three Corbett appointees, traded pornographic emails. Medvick doubts many voters will blame Corbett for the actions of adults in his employ, but he says the story distracts from the governor's messaging at a time he needs to make up ground. And there's one more thing.
If it gives people just the sense that state government's not working, just in general, it's just another thing that makes people a little sour on the current administration, and in that sense, it's really not good for the governor.
There was a consensus among observers that Corbett was more forceful and specific in the candidate's first debate. Expect Wolf to try and reverse that this time. Dave Davies, WHYY News.
The debate gets underway at 8 tomorrow morning on KYW. Acme is letting shoppers know about an attempt by hackers to steal information. WHYY's Jessica McDonald reports on the data breach of the grocery chain.
There's no evidence yet of any theft, but Acme is warning customers who used credit or debit cards in late August and September that their payment information might be compromised. That includes names and card numbers, but not the personal information, such as a social security number, that would allow criminals to open new credit cards. Paul Stevens of the Policy Rights Clearinghouse says these data breaches are increasingly common.
We've heard of consumers who have actually had their credit or debit cards reissued by their financial institution as often as 3 or 4 times in 1 year.
Stevens says the U.S. still uses a magnetic strip to encode information on cards. Most other developed nations use a more secure chip card.
The chip card is encrypted and generates a one-time use code so that in the event of a breach, the information is essentially useless.
Stevens advises cardholders to check statements for fraudulent charges and report them right away. He also recommends getting rid of debit cards because it can take up to 2 weeks to have the money restored. I'm Jessica McDonald, WHYY News.
Of course, Acme is not the first retailer to announce a major data breach. Joining us to discuss how Acme and others have handled the fallout is Rob DeVidio, Associate Professor of Criminology at Drexel University. Professor DeVidio, thanks for joining us on NewsWorks Tonight.
Thank you for having me.
So here we have Acme joining an ever-growing list of big retailers, Target, of course, Home Depot, Neiman Marcus, Barnes & Noble, and on and on and on. Target was the first big one, and they sent a Dear Target guest list to their customers. I didn't know I was a Target guest. To what effect?
You know, I think that Target did some things that were very good, did some things that were poor. Target was spot on in getting the word out there very quickly. And I applaud them and other retailers for making notification very quickly to consumers. Where they went wrong is they put too much detail in the letters based upon the information that they had available at that time. I think merchants want to let consumers know because consumers need to put in place there are actions that they need to take to protect their credit and their financial security. However, what they don't need is misinformation. So when Target put information out there about the breach and then they had to retract that information at a later time because new facts became available, it didn't bode well for them. I was shocked when I read the press release from Acme today. What Acme has said is, yes, there was a breach, but your information wasn't stolen. But in the next sentence, then they go about telling you how they've secured the services of forensic computer analysts to go and look into the situation more. What that tells me as someone who's done the forensic type of examinations that they're talking about is that they still don't know all the facts. So by them putting information out there and telling you and I that our information hasn't been stolen, and then 2 weeks from now they come out and tell us they've done tremendous damage to their brand. The information, if it's not already out there, it will be out there soon enough on these carding websites.
And this isn't unique to the Acme situation. Anytime your credit card...
It's what we saw with Target. It's what we saw with Home Depot. These online communities that are operating as Tor hidden services in what we call the dark net, that's the place to go to fence these stolen documents. So with those bits of information that were accessed in the Acme breach, according to what Acme has said, I can certainly card or what we call... Or carding is the technical term for it, but create counterfeit credit cards. And that falls under the rubric of identity theft.
Professor, leave us with something good. In your work in the lab, what's in the future, 5, 10, 20 years out, that could really nip this in the bud?
Well, you know, when it comes to notification, I know, you know, data breaches are a difficult thing to mitigate for, you know, especially for multinational companies with tens of thousands of people potentially falling victim. Our research shows that companies are not falling behind with respect to providing customers with details and ways to mitigate. But if they want to safeguard their brands, if they want to minimize any adverse impact that customers who have been caught up in this breach have towards returning to shop with that particular brand, customers first and foremost are looking for an apology. And that runs counter to everything you're legal advisors are going to tell you. But our research shows definitively customers want an apology and they want those messages to be written in a clear and concise manner with obvious brand awareness. We call those impressive artifacts that are contained within these letters. So you can learn something for, you know, they can learn a lot and gain a lot by apologizing and admitting fault.
From the criminal justice end, though, is it relatively risk-free for hackers? What penalties are they risking?
It's relatively risk-free. You know, right now we would be so hard-pressed to apprehending someone in Russia, for instance, right? The Russian authorities aren't going to cooperate, and we need them to cooperate. And I'm not saying this breach originated from Russia or from China, but when you look at where these breaches are originating from, you know, 6 months, 12 months after the fact, where we've certainly uncovered all the facts and we are able to pinpoint their locations, you know, they're getting away with it. And there's very little we can do.
If we can't get superpower cooperation on ISIL, I'm not sure it's going to be forthcoming anytime soon on this issue.
Identity theft is so, so low on the totem pole.
Professor, thanks for joining us on NewsWorks Tonight.
Thank you.
That's Rob DeVideo, Associate Professor of Criminology at Drexel University, and you can hear more of our conversation at newsworks.org. The Philadelphia School District is selling off buildings that it shut over the past few years. NewsWorks blogger Solomon Jones says the district is selling taxpayers and students short.
The School Reform Commission recently announced the pending sales of 11 schools, netting just $2 million for the school district. There's just one problem. The schools in question are valued at more than $76 million under the city's new property valuation system. The school district says the low net profit is due to bonds that must be repaid on the buildings. But there's another reason as well. PIDC, the quasi-public agency that handled the sales, started the bidding at just pennies on the dollar. Bach High School, for example, was valued at more than $17.8 million by the city, but was ultimately sold to a developer for less than 12% of its value. Reynolds Elementary School, which sits in the middle of an impoverished community known as Sharswood, was sold to the Philadelphia Housing Authority. That sale lines up with a previous plan to tear down the nearby Blumberg Apartments, a public housing high-rise that has long been seen as an impediment to development there. That barrier could soon be removed, because PHA was chosen as one of 9 agencies nationwide to win a Choice Neighborhoods Planning Grant. The $500,000 grant is supposed to aid in putting together a plan to revitalize Sharswood, and PHA says it is working with more than a dozen neighborhood groups and city agencies to craft that plan. When the planning process is complete, PHA will apply for a $30 million Choice Neighborhoods Implementation Grant to bring the plan to fruition. The implosion of much of the high-rise portion of the Blumberg Apartments will be part of that plan. That would clear the way for development that could connect Sharswood with rapidly developing areas like Brewerytown to the west, Francisville to the south, and Temple University to the east. That could lead to gentrification, moving out poor residents for the rich. City Council President Daryl Clark, who represents the area, told me in a radio interview that affordable housing will be part of the plan in Sharswood and that PHA could also move its headquarters to the area. But that's not my concern right now. My main concern is that schools in impoverished neighborhoods across the city have once again been devalued. Not only were they closed, displacing vulnerable children as a result, they are now a seeming metaphor for our school system as a whole. It's almost as if the schools, the children, and even the communities in which they sit are viewed as having little value. There's still time for Philadelphians to be heard on this issue, and we must do so, because our schools have more value than the school district has placed on them. Our kids have more value as well. This is Solomon Jones.
Solomon Jones writes the Philadelphia Experiment blog at newsworks.org. Turning to this evening's headlines, Pennsylvania Governor Tom Corbett has signed into law a bill that supporters say will reduce the number of fatal heroin overdoses in the state. The legislation makes the antidote commonly known as Narcan more available to police and the public. Narcan reverses the effects of heroin and opioids like OxyContin. The new law also offers Good Samaritans immunity from criminal prosecution for helping overdose victims. 2 more iron workers have pleaded guilty in the union violence cases that involved the arson of the Quaker Meeting House in the Chestnut Hill section of Philadelphia. Prosecutors say Edward Sweeney of Philadelphia has admitted a role in 2 fires and 10 extortion attempts. And according to authorities, Sean Bailey of Philadelphia pleaded guilty today to extorting a non-union contractor. 74 degrees on Independence Mall. It's 6:17. You're listening to Newsworks Tonight on WHYY. Clouding up this evening, there's a chance of showers overnight, low 62 degrees. Tomorrow, cloudy to start, turning partly sunny, Wednesday's high 72. Thursday, enjoy intervals of sun and clouds, high again in the low 70s. Friday, partly sunny, though there's a 30% chance of showers in the afternoon, high 76. Showers likely Saturday morning, then partly sunny, high 68. Still ahead, a story of a transformation from criminal to budding criminologist.
Robbing, pulling guns on people, there's no justification for committing crime. Like, I realize that now.
Newsworks Tonight continues on WHYY. Welcome back to Newsworks Tonight. I'm Dave Heller. For many Philadelphians striving to escape poverty, the Community College of Philadelphia acts as a gateway. In every corner of its urban campuses, students struggle to defy the odds. WHYY's Kevin McCrory gives us this tale of one of CCP's most recent successes, a man who went from armed robbery to criminology courses at LaSalle University.
Quaris Carter arrived in North Philadelphia a stranger to the East Coast, carrying 2 garbage bags of clothes and barely a dime. After more than 3 decades in Texas, he was just grateful for the chance to redefine his life.
I actually started to see myself change. I started to feel free. I didn't have to go on somewhere new. It's a new start.
This was July of 2010. The story of how he got there, and within 4 years, graduated from community college, is a tale of American reinvention, one that begins in Houston's drug-riddled Fifth Ward neighborhood at the height of the 1980s crack epidemic. The son of a devout Southern Baptist single mother, Carter says he was a good student for a while. Then,
everyone's telling me to get money, and I figured getting money was on the way out. My mom never knew I sold crack until a year ago. Because she never caught me. She never seen me with money. The money that she actually got off me, when she searched me when I came home, I told her I was shooting dice. She's like, well, don't be shooting dice, but as long as you're not selling drugs.
At 12, already drinking and smoking weed, he was making $500 a week dealing crack after school, often selling to adults who were more than twice his age.
We had older guys, 5, 6 years older, who told us, hey, don't, first of all, they don't do it. And then they this is how you do it. So it wasn't structured we had a boss or underboss or a gang leader. It wasn't like that.
By high school, though, Carter quit selling. And so for a while, he was a quintessential Texas teenager. He joined the football team and earned cash by mowing lawns and washing cars. But that phase, too, did not last. Twenty-some years later, in Philadelphia, Carter, now 38, lives in a $350 a month rooming house on a dilapidated corner of Diamond Street in North Philadelphia. To afford the application fee to community college, he had to sell his plasma at a blood bank. Once he enrolled, two of his sociology professors urged him to ride the 23 bus from Center City to Chestnut Hill. The bus sputters past the full swath of city life, from downtrodden storefronts and vacant lots to million-dollar homes on the city's edge.
And they just start telling me, you need to start building social and cultural capital. You need to start getting out and meet different people, different social classes, and they can show you how beautiful life is.
On a recent Friday, we retrace that journey, looking through the scuffs on the big bus window as the urban terrain changed. During the course of the trip, Carter meditated on the mistakes of his past. As we jumped off the bus at Germantown in Indiana, Carter said that after graduating high school, he went to the University of Houston.
Well, I was doing well, but I had no family support. They were still telling me, college is good, but you need to go get a job and just help pay some bills and things like that. So I just stopped going to school. After that, I just started committing crime.
Some guys he knew from the neighborhood had been robbing jewelry stores at gunpoint.
They was like, look, you have a better life right now. You can't, don't be lazy. Let's go get this money. And I seen they was doing it, so I was like, cool. And I knew I was smarter than them. So I back then applied myself.
If a store opened at 9, Carter and his crew would show up at 9:02 with ski masks and automatic weapons.
I had a policy, that never shoot anyone. If you don't shoot anyone. You know what I'm saying? They're going to give it to you. It's not theirs. Don't shoot them. You know what I'm saying? If you shoot them, somebody's going to shoot you.
Carter had a connection that would pay him $10,000 to $15,000 for each duffel bag full of jewelry.
I was like, this is stupid, but it's money. And those I got money, people will not respect me. I knew they wouldn't respect me, but I'm like, they would like me.
He was soon arrested and sentenced to 3 years in prison. After he got out, he worked as an electrician, but then started robbing again. And again, he was arrested. He did another 6 years behind bars. Waiting to catch the bus at Germantown in Glenwood, Carter said committing crimes was the stupidest thing he's ever done.
Robbing, pulling guns on people, there's no justification for committing crime. I realize that now. Just because you're poor doesn't mean you commit crime. I'm not committing crime now, and I'm poor.
Locked up the second time, he says reading Nelson Mandela's A Long Walk to Freedom changed him.
I was like, if he could do that, I have no reason to give up on my life. If he could do it for 27 years, I have no reason. So I just made my mind up, I'm not going to give up.
Released from prison, Carter fled to the East Coast with nothing, even though it meant leaving behind his teenage daughter.
I started seeing, some of the same old behaviors, because some of the people that I know, they started contacting me and I started hanging around them, but I wanted to change because I didn't want to go back.
Back on the bus, we plodded through Germantown proper and then into more affluent Mount Airy.
Mount Pleasant Avenue, Route 8.
Carter recalled that when he first got to Philly, he bounced between homeless shelters and drug recovery programs.
Once I started going to Narcotics Anonymous meetings, I started seeing, they started talking about, we're going to love you until you learn how to love yourself.
A therapist saw his intellectual potential and pushed him to try community college, where, with the help of a few committed faculty mentors, he made it into the honors program. He graduated from CCP in the spring and has begun coursework at LaSalle to finish his bachelor's degree in sociology and criminal justice. When we got off the bus at the edge of the city in Chestnut Hill, Carter breathed a noticeable sigh of relief.
Feels like freedom.
Police officers on horseback smiled and waved as they clicked and clacked across the cobblestones.
People over here, like, they're used to success. They don't feel that entitlement where they have to take something from someone else. Where Germantown, Indiana, it felt like at any moment anything could happen.
When Carter needs a break from life in North Philly, this is where he comes to clear his head. One day, Carter dreams of buying a house here, a place where maybe his daughter, now also in college, could come and stay. But he says he's only able to even have that thought because of his renewed belief in his own power to learn.
The way out doesn't have to consist of crime, drugs, violence, suicides, none of that. You know what I'm saying? Just talk to someone and seek that education.
For WHYY News, I'm Kevin McCory.
Finally this evening, Philadelphia finds itself as a high seed in a new tournament, up against several other major U.S. cities. Unfortunately, it has nothing to do with the city's sports teams. Gawkers, America's ugliest accent tournament, started yesterday, and visitors to the site can vote in the 16-city playoff. Our sometimes infamous pronunciations like water instead of water have earned the city a fifth seed in the first round, facing Memphis's Southern Drawl. As much as placing that high might sting for Philadelphians, apparently we're not even the worst accent in Pennsylvania. Pittsburgh is the number 4 seed, Scranton number 2. That's all for tonight's show. NewsWorks Tonight is produced by Shai Ben-Yakov and Kimberly Haas. Download a podcast of this and other episodes of the show at newsworks.org. Tomorrow evening, we'll continue our series on Pennsylvania's energy industries as we look into the future of wind power in the state. Thanks for joining us. I'm Dave Heller for NewsWorks Tonight.